Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we'll begin with the surprising ways that Hollywood actors have shaped American politics and who have been some of the most groundbreaking and influential on the body politic. Then, dozens of species are going extinct every day and more face extinction with the onset of climate change. These realities have given rise to some scientists exploring the possibility of de-extinction, bringing back some species through cloning. Should it be done? Is it ethical? Is it practical? And how do they affect our health and our politics? In 1918, the leaders of the FBI, William Burns and J. Edgar Hoover, expressed deep concern about the power of movie stars to affect politics. And so they began a surveillance program to watch over those whom they thought might be radicals. Their surveillance revealed some stars who had become part of the so-called Red Movement. Since then, it has long seemed that Hollywood crowd was ideologically left. But our next guest says that's actually not true. Stephen Ross joins us in studio for a two-part discussion about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. He's a historian at the University of Southern California and author of numerous books, including this one, Hollywood Left and Right. Welcome, Stephen Ross. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I think I want to start with one of your premises, and here's a quote right out of your book. Movie stars do more than just show us how to dress, look, or love. They teach us how to think and act politically. How so?
Well, I think one of the great things that movie stars do and have done since the 19-teens, is they draw attention to issues. And people who are anti-Hollywood, and it's not even conservatives, because you have a lot of conservative stars who have been political, but people who are anti-Hollywood just simply dismiss it and see it as star worship and what can they tell us, et cetera, et cetera. They miss the big point. The big point is, right from the start, when movie stars started going out on the road, starting in World War I, selling war bonds, or when they started going out on the road with candidates, what would happen, the biggest influence movie stars have had is actually they get us to think. It's not what they have to say. That our lives are busy. We often don't pay attention to things. We think things are, it's the same old, whether it was 1917 or today. But suddenly when somebody you get that you admire gets involved in either a cause or a candidate, it draws your attention. And once it draws your attention, you're the one who decides, am I going to actually read something about this? Am I going to listen to this person? Am I going to find more about this cause? And what has done it is, again, it's the celebrity who has brought you to it. But we're, and again, these polls, I get very upset when I read these polls about, well, is so-and-so, is Oprah's endorsement, let's go back to 2008, first time she endorses a candidate, is Oprah's endorsement more likely to make you vote for Obama? It's the wrong question. It's kind of like saying, when did you stop beating your husband or wife? Either way, you sound like an idiot. The real question should be, would Oprah's endorsement or any star get you to pay more attention to a candidate or an issue?
So it's the agenda setting function.
That's right, because otherwise if you say, yes, it's going to get me more likely to vote, you sound like a moron, that you have no real brain. And in fact, what it is it simply gets you to pause for a moment and say, okay, let me actually think about this.
Do you think it's really because when somebody has achieved celebrity status that all of the news media then call attention to the issue? Or is it the celebrity status itself?
It's both. First of all, we've now gone on 24/7 news. If you notice, you go through history, all Jack Kennedy's affairs, none of them got reported at the time, A, because there was a kind of code, an ethos. But I will tell you, if Kennedy had lived through 24/7 media, that ethos would have gone out of the door because they simply needed copy. So it's gotten, in other words, there's always been a kind of celebrity worship in the media. It's always good for business. Let's remember, it's a business. The celebrity business is a business. It's not just about your fantasies. It's selling them. And so, if you want to get, whether it's ratings on TV or ratings, getting people to buy your newspapers, you want the kind of gossipy stuff that's going to draw attention. And celebrities draw attention.
That also brings up the kind of relationship people have with celebrities. You say it's a love-hate relationship.
Right. You can, for example, really like a movie star. And let's say you're an action kind of movie person. and you've always loved Mel Gibson. And then you find out who he really is. And suddenly, I can't tell you how many people I know said, including myself, I'll never go see a Mel Gibson movie again. And
because people thought he was the character before.
Yes, and they thought he was a certain kind of person. And what happens, and this is something William DeMille, who is the left-wing brother of Cecil DeMille, the most conservative director, talked about even in the 1930s, that we love our movie stars until they actually speak out on something controversial, and then they turn out to have feet of clay. So if you're a Democrat and you hear a Republican speaking out, or a movie star that you didn't know their politics, suddenly speaking out in a very conservative fashion, it would likely turn you off. Likewise, if you're conservative and you hear some star that you didn't know what their politics were speaking out on a left-wing agenda, you get turned off. And, you know, we can go back to Sid Grauman, who had Grauman's Chinese, who was one of the more innovative exhibitors of his time. He would warn movie stars in the 19-teens, never speak out politically, and I can sort of quote him here, never speak out politically because the moment you do, it's bad for the old box office-aroo. And you can bring that all the way up to Michael Jordan at his peak was often questioned by, you know, reporters from Nation and places like this, sort of more left progressive, saying, how come you don't use your star personality to speak out on issues of importance, particularly race issues? And his response is, Republicans buy Nikes. And my response to him is, Mr. Jordan, how wealthy do you have to be? But you know what? There are people who don't want their image soiled, and it's true. The moment you open your mouth as a movie star, you are going to alienate half of your potential audience.
And you aptly point out in your book that throughout Hollywood, that this has really guided so many actors to avoid politics, and yet there were those that went forward. You picked 10 of them.
That's correct.
And 10 of them for several reasons, including their impact. 5 on the right, 5 on the left. Let's start with any common thread that you saw among them.
Well, the most interesting thing is many of them came from what you could call broken homes. And I still haven't, I'm a historian rather than a psychologist, although I often play a psychologist in everyday life. But I don't really know. It would be hard. But so many of them had Charlie Chaplin, drunken father, Louis B. Mayer. I'm going in order now. A father that would kind of beat him and accused him of working too hard rather than going and studying the Talmud. Edward G. Robinson, a father that didn't hurt him in any way, but he never talked about his girlfriends. And he didn't even have a girlfriend till he was like 30. And he was afraid to bring her home because she was a shiksa, you know, non-Jew. And you can go to Reagan, and these are the people I'm talking about in order of my book. Reagan and Murphy both had, Murphy's father died early. Reagan's father was an alcoholic. You move ahead to Jane Fonda, Henry Fonda, one of the worst fathers in Hollywood. Charlton Heston coming from a broken home. Harry Belafonte, a father who left the family very early on. Warren Beatty, a father who had trouble with alcohol. Arnold Schwarzenegger, a father who was rough on the kids. Everyone seemed to have difficult fathers. Now, how you figure that, you ask me what's the common thread? That's one of them. The other thing, if there's a common thread in the more admirable, it's that all 10 were willing to take a risk. And that is something rare. All 10 of them understood that speaking out politically could hurt them in the box office. Even Louis B. Mayer, it could hurt his studio. But all 10 of them felt it was incumbent upon them as a citizen. And to that extent, that's why I say I really admire all 10 politically. I may not like their politics, and in the case of Louis B. Mayer, I may not like him personally, but I admire somebody who is willing to do that risk, who's willing to put their money where their mouth is.
Now, Louis B. Mayer, first of all, I'm going to ask you to remind listeners who he is. It seemed that he was the one that used politics to help his business more than the others.
Yes. Well, Louis B. Mayer was the head of MGM Studios, really the first head. And what people don't know, one of the things I bring in the book is I deal with two what I call myths of Hollywood. And that led me to have these counterintuitive theses that, again, I like to write books about things I don't know, so I get surprised. And the sort of common wisdom about Hollywood is it's filled with lefties and liberals, and that it's always been this way. It's always been the bastion of the left. And one of the things I found was first that conservatives have a longer history in Hollywood than liberals do. And second, that even though the Hollywood left has been more numerous and visible, the Hollywood right has actually had a greater impact on American political life and on the nature of the American state. And it really starts with Louis B. Mayer, because he is really the first key political figure in Hollywood. You have Charlie Chaplin before then, who's making what I call anti-authoritarian films. But Chaplin is sort of on his own. Mayer is the first person to create a relationship between a studio and a political party. He is the man who brings the Republican Party into Hollywood, and he brings Hollywood into the Republican Party. And he turns MGM into a publicity wing of the GOP. And he goes on, he's serious enough that he goes on to become the head of the California GOP. He's a power broker at the 1928 presidential primaries. He strikes a deal, a secret deal between Herbert Hoover and William Randolph Hearst, that gives Hoover enough delegates to get the nomination on the first ballot. And Mayer, a number of his films also take a very, as opposed to the Warner Brothers, which kind of take a left liberal point of view of American life, Mayer's studio really puts forth a conservative ideology. And as I write about in the book, nothing more on the nose for today's conservative politics than the one series he put his heart into, which was the Hardy Family series, the most successful series in MGM history. And if you watch these movies, starring Mickey Rooney, and some of them have Judy Garland, but some of them not, what you see is it's Ronald Reagan's, it is the basis of Reagan's Morning in America. It's God, family, and country are all we need. And you never need to rely on the government. You need to rely on God, family, patriotism, and your sort of home community. And that will solve all the problems. It's not government. It's the sort of local people pulling together. And he does it in a very appealing fashion. And it does it in a fashion that you want to believe it, because then everything's going to be fine.
The other interesting thing about him was what he did to sort of catapult the Republican Party in terms of bringing in tactics, like you mentioned, the dirty politics. How did he do that?
Well, the other, again, what I was surprised by, it's been the Republicans and the conservatives, not the liberals and Democrats, who have actually pioneered the uses of mass media for political ends. Two things Mayer did early on, well, three things he did early on that were really interesting. The first is, as I mentioned, he turned MGM into a publicity wing of the Republican Party. And what do I mean by that? Anytime a famous Republican figure would come through L.A., whether it was a congressperson, a senator, a governor, president, Mayer would find out who their favorite actor, actresses were. Whether they were at MGM or not, he would bring them onto the studio lot. He would build a special set for a lunch. He would put the candidate on the dais and then put the two movie stars on either side of him. He would then make sure he had his studio photographers come in. And the next day, a picture of that politician and these famous movie stars would go out on every wire service throughout the country, giving that politician a patina of glamour that any potential opponent would lack. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get a politician with Mary Pickford or Douglas Fairbanks or one of his people there. And, you know, that was, he understood the power of glamour and publicity and using it for politics. Mayer was also put in charge of the 1928 Republican convention to make it lively. And the 24 convention was broadcast on some radios, and it was considered an island of dullness. And even though we can't imagine, well, how can you make radio exciting? He tried to create a program at the committee filled with bands, filled with balloons coming down, filled with a sense of excitement, so that when listeners heard it on the radio. What they heard were bands. They heard fanfare. They heard that this was something really exciting and that they could imagine it, that he turned politics into the excitement of the imagination. And it would be his protege, George Murphy, who would instruct Republicans. He was really the first one. He tried in 48 with Dewey, who wouldn't listen to him, Thomas Dewey, who ran against Truman. And that was the famous election where Dewey got too arrogant, thinking he was so far ahead he couldn't lose. And he did. And Murphy was trying to say, no, you come across on TV terribly. And when Ike ran in 52, Murphy and Robert Montgomery became Ike's TV consultants. But the other thing he did was dirty tricks that in many ways preceded the Kerry Bush campaign, where in 1934, Upton Sinclair, a longtime socialist, switched over to the Democratic Party, figuring he's never going to win as a socialist, but maybe he could win as a Democrat, was running for governor, and it looked like he was on the path to win. And Mayer came back from a European vacation and came to a studio because he was alerted to the fact that this was going to be bad for business, that Sinclair City was going to raise taxes on the studios. And so he sent out a reporter to do these semi-fake newsreels. And what they did is they sent this the roving reporter around the state, and he would interview people. There were three candidates, Republican, Democrat, and a sort of third dark horse figure. And the main opposition was the Republican Merriam. And what he did is he would have staged actors. So, for example, he had the reporter interviewing a black Republican, a man who is in front of his home, clearly a homeowner, white shirt, because costuming matters, how you present somebody, a bow tie, totally clean. Who are you going to vote for? I'm going to vote for Merriam, because he will give us jobs, and I've done well for myself through hard work and blah, blah, blah. And you see, he's got his home, or at least it appears that way. And then they go to talk to some black voters who might be voting for Sinclair, and they walk up to a car, and there's a bunch of African-Americans in the car, and when they roll down the window, all the smoke comes out, and you know they've been smoking weed in the car. It's so clear. And who are you voting for? Oh, man, we're going to vote for Sinclair. And the same thing, they get immigrants. They have an immigrant. Who are you going to vote for? And the one immigrant who says he's going to vote for Merriam is well-dressed. He speaks with a slight accent. But then the guy who's going to be for Sinclair speaks like he's a Russian revolutionary. And, you know, it was Sinclair is going to support the same kind of program they had in Russia. And it was good for there, and it's going to be good for here. So it's all these faked interviews that make it seem like if you vote for Sinclair, you're going to bring the communist revolution to America. And as a result of that, as well as Hearst running a similar smear campaign, where he's showing all these bums coming in, saying that they're coming in because Sinclair's promising work for all of us, until somebody points out in a rival newspaper that the photograph that Sinclair had of the bums coming in Hearst's newspaper was actually a still from Warner Brothers' Wild Boys of the Road. So they had to run a retraction that, in fact, it wasn't true. But this is something Mayer pioneered and the Republicans would use over the years. They understood, how do you use media, even in a dirty way, to sway popular opinion?
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with historian Stephen Ross about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is out in paperback. One of the things that I noticed that seemed like a theme is that those actors and movie stars who were on the right and conservative side seemed to continue on with more or less a successful life, whereas those that were more on the left were sort of demonized at some point, you know, whether it was Jane Fonda or whether it was Charlie Chaplin, and they seemed to have a much more difficult time.
Yes. And part of that has to do with the question of war. If there's a lesson here, it's if you come out ahead of public opinion on a war, and particularly opposition to the war, you are going to be demonized. And Ellen Goodman had a line that I love. We give medals to movie stars on the right and FBI dossiers to movie stars on the left. So you think that the careers of Charlie Chaplin and Edward G. Robinson were ruined because they were what Hueck and the Red Scare would later call premature anti-fascists. One of the most ridiculous phrases I've ever heard in my life, that during the 1930s, they were urging us to support the Allied cause and to oppose fascism. And they were joining with groups, particularly Robinson, and very later on, after he made The Great Dictator, Chaplin joined in. And we have this myth of the good war. We have this idea that Americans recognized Hitler immediately and knew how evil he was. And it is a myth, because in November 1936, you had something like 95% of the American population against any involvement with what was happening in Europe. And even as late as July 1941, and now we're talking almost 2 years into the war, you had 79% of Americans who had seen Hitler, had seen Mussolini, had seen what they were doing. They still wanted nothing to do with the war. So in a way, people like Chaplin, people like Edward G. Robinson, and many of the blacklisted, the Hollywood 10, should have been applauded later on, saying, you know, you guys told us what was right and wrong, and you saw it early. But instead, their careers were over because they were seen as aligned with communists. And the same thing would happen to Jane Fonda during the Vietnam War. You can get, one could argue to this day, you know, people like Sean Penn, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, you know, came under terrible fire for their opposition to Iraq. And the irony is, every one of these left stars who suffered because they talked about anti-war in one case or getting involved in fighting fascism, history shows every one of them was right, and yet every one of them gets punished.
One of your more conservative actors actually collaborated with the Nazi government in some ways, bringing over the newspaper
right.
editors.
Well, kowtow is the word I would use. Starting in 1934, Adolf Hitler told the Hollywood studios that any one of you who has an office in Germany needs to fire any of your Jewish employees. We will not tolerate it. And if you don't fire those employees, we will not allow your studio to exhibit any of its films, either in Germany or any area we control. And every single studio except for Warner Brothers went along with it. They fired the Jewish employees. Warner Brothers responded by shutting down their operation, shutting down their office in Germany and moving it to England. And part of the reason is the studios were making 30 to 40% of their profits from foreign distribution, and they didn't want to risk their profits. And the incident you're mentioning is in June 1939. There are 10 Nazi newspaper editors touring L.A., and Mayer welcomes them onto the MGM lot and gives them a tour of the studio. And I saw some correspondence in the Warner Brothers files of somebody writes to Harry Warner saying, can't you talk to this guy? He's crazy. How can he tour these Nazis? You're a Jew. And Warner writes back saying, you know, Louis B. Mayer is going to do whatever he wants. No one can tell him what to do.
Let's back up a little bit and precede Mayer and go to Charlie Chaplin. Would you say he was the pioneer in using his film to affect the Americans politically?
He was a pioneer, yes. He's what I call the first political movie star. And that is, his politics were very eclectic, but they were kind of definitely left. And what I call, he was an instinctual radical. That, you know, he dropped out of school in elementary school. He was an autodidact. He taught himself everything. He was quite a bright man, but not consistent. He considered himself a socialist. At the time, he was the wealthiest man in Hollywood. And at the same time, he was, because of his upbringing, he was always pathologically afraid of being plunged back into poverty. And people who knew him well talked about his pathological cheapness. That I interviewed somebody, Larry Bachman, who used to play tennis with him. Chaplin was a little older. Bachman was on the tennis team at USC in the 1920s. And he told me Charlie Chaplin could break his arm reaching away from a check.
It came from the poverty he came from, though, right? It's like people who grew up in poverty often can't lose it.
Well, he grew up in something worse than poverty, which is when he was really small, his family was actually fairly well-to-do. They had a multi-bedroom apartment with a maid. And then his father started drinking again. The parents split up. His mother got sick, and they eventually wound up going from poorer to poorer to poorer circumstances until she was sent finally to an insane asylum, and he and his brother were sent to a workhouse. And at that point, they were in total poverty. And so he was always afraid. And yet, when you watch his early films, they are what I call anti-authoritarian, that he begins, in a sense, getting his instinctual politics. He doesn't want to do it left-right on the nose, but instead, his early films are constantly attacking authority figures up and down the class ladder, from employers to landlords to judges. Anyone who gives the working class people and immigrants a hard time really comes in for attack. And it's only by the 1930s, as he's by the 1920s, starts touring the world, and he realizes world leaders, major intellectual leaders, and H.G. Wells, people like this, they all want to talk to him. George Bernard Shaw, they want to talk to him about ideas. And it's not until the 1930s that he has enough self-confidence that his films become much more politically focused. So he'll make Modern Times in 1936, and then The Great Dictator in 1940. And then after the war, he really goes to town and makes Monsieur Verdu and a number of films that get him totally into trouble. Where his films are being boycotted, he's being protested, and that's when he leaves the country.
Today, we've got Warren Beatty, we've got Charlton Heston, the legacy of Ronald Reagan. Do you see a development of how their politics have come, or do you see them more individually compartmentalized?
It's interesting. I would say stars on the left have been more individually compartmentalized, and ironically, the stars on the right have followed a trajectory of how to use media. And again, not just followed a trajectory, created a trajectory of how to use media to further their political goals. So I mentioned Louis B. Mayer is the first one who starts with radio and figures out radio. And also Mayer, by 28 and 32, is staging the Republican conventions, and he's turning them into entertainment venues. He says, you know, a convention is no different than a movie opening. So you got to stage, it has to be a big hullabaloo, it has to be a big gathering. People need to want to see it rather than ought to see it.
We will continue our conversation with Stephen Ross on Hollywood Left and Right next week. This is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. And next up, should science bring back some species from extinction? Stay tuned.
Again in town, was sitting by his sweetheart's side. And when his sweetheart said, come on, let's settle down, Wildcat raised his head and cried, oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees.
Hello, you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Planet Earth is facing the worst spate of extinction since the loss of the dinosaurs, according to the Center for Biological Diversity. Dozens of species are going extinct every day, and more face extinction with the onset of climate change. These realities have given rise to some scientists exploring the possibility of de-extinction, bringing back some species through cloning. Should it be done? Is it ethical? Is it practical? We're joined by three experts. Michael Archer is a professor of biological, earth, and environmental sciences at the University of New South Wales. He has published more than 300 scientific journal articles focusing on the ecology and evolution of past and present, and has been working to bring back some extinct animals. John Weens is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona and author of numerous publications and the book The Ecology of Bird Communities. He is also a former curator at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History and has served as editor for a number of scientific journals. Carl Zimmer also joins us. He's an award-winning lecturer at Yale University and the author of 13 books, including A Planet of Viruses and Evolution, the Triumph of an Idea. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, National Geographic, and Scientific American. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with what the scope is that we're facing with regards to mass extinction on the planet. I understand it's pretty unprecedented. Michael Archer, is this something you can help us to understand?
I'm a paleontologist, and certainly we've been documenting the dreadful outcomes of the previous five mass extinctions the planet suffered. Sometimes it's taken out 85% of the creatures on the planet. But there are intimations already that the sixth great extinction is underway and we're the cause. And the rate at which things are going extinct at the moment appears as unprecedented as anything we've ever seen before. It's roughly the equivalent of when that meteor came in and took out the big non-flying dinosaurs.
Except for we don't have a meteor right now.
Well, we're the meteor, unfortunately, and we're really hitting the planet hard. It's a thing we have to take seriously into consideration. You know, if it's us doing it, then we've got to really ask ourselves, do we know what we're doing here? One of the footnotes to this that's disturbing is in the previous five mass extinctions, on average, it takes 10 million years for the planet to stabilize its ecosystems again. And you really have to ask, are we prepared to have that happen on the other side of what we're doing on the planet at the moment?
I know climate change is a big cause of extinction. What are the other activities that we are doing that is creating this problem?
One of the saddest things, unfortunately, has to do with what we perceived 10,000 years ago was the appropriate way for humans to feed themselves. And that meant we started to focus on a very few species that we could grow and stockpile and through this increase our own numbers. This is agriculture. In order to get agriculture, every continent on which this has been inflicted, we've swept aside the natural ecosystems and the species along with them in order to plant very few of these foreign species that were introduced to all the other continents. Australia was one of the last ones to have this affliction, but it's suffering now. We've lost 18 of our precious mammals, largely because of land clearing. But then along with that, of course, we have introduced onto every continent a few animal species that we have valued, like sheep and cattle, and moved all the natives aside until eventually they've had no room to survive. And we see this terrible cascade of extinctions following hard on the heels of agriculture.
John Weens.
You know, my understanding is that we're estimating now that we're going to lose between maybe 50%, maybe 67% of all the species that are on the planet now, even though we don't have a clear idea of how many species that is. I think Michael's exactly right. The big problem seems to be habitat destruction, or at least people are estimating that we're going to lose half or two-thirds of all the species on the planet just considering habitat destruction alone. And that's not sort of thinking about climate change. It's sort of a wild card. We don't know what it's going to do. But it's particularly frightening because we can set up reserves and national parks to protect habitats, obviously from habitat destruction, but then lots of species may go extinct inside those reserves and national parks because of climate change.
Carl Zimmer.
The dire situation that we're facing is actually causing conservation biologists to give serious thought to the traditional ways that they have tried to preserve species. As John mentioned, the traditional thing would be to set up a preserve. But if climate totally changes the conditions in that preserve, then you haven't done much good. And so one idea that people have is that you might move some of those species to places where they might have a better chance of surviving, sometimes called assisted migration. But the problem there is that there may not necessarily be any place to move them where they have all the right conditions to survive. So these biologists are really grappling with just how truly serious the situation is.
And so scientists are exploring all these different aspects of it. And one of them that triggered this program today specifically dealt with the de-extinction efforts. Michael Archer, you're one of the leaders on this. What are the advances scientifically that are making it possible to bring animals back from extinction, or maybe not even just animals, maybe plant species?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of opportunities that are opening up. I raised this question, back in about 2000 when I was very interested in knowing whether we could recover the DNA from one of Australia's iconic animals. It's kind of our king of beasts, called the thylacine, or Tasmanian tiger. And when I asked, could we get that DNA back out of a pickled specimen that we had, which theoretically was possible, there was just laughter. And that was barely 13 years ago. Now, technology has streaked ahead. George Church, in his book Regenesis, has outlined many of the new technologies, the new machines that can work with fragmented DNA. There is letter-by-letter gene replacement techniques that enable you to work with, say, the genetic understanding of a living animal and change it step-by-step to match the recovered DNA from an extinct animal. So there are so many new and exciting things happening. There are other people also traveling under this banner of de-extinction that are involved in kind of trying to deconstruct living animals to see what's in their ancestry behind the living animal. The living animal still carries the genes of extinct ancestors. And increasingly, it's possible through selective breeding to start to recover those ancient genes and hopefully begin to bring back one of the prehistoric animals. There are other groups that are looking at even de-extincting environments. I mean, we're talking here now about bringing back a mammoth or a thylacine or a frog, but it's also possible to think about bringing back whole ecosystems. Much of the instability that affects the planet at the moment is because we've had what are called trophic cascades. You extinct some key animal, and then a whole lot of other things that depended on it also disappear. So there are other people working on trying to, for example, bring back the Pleistocene world that used to be here 10,000 years ago and see if you can reinstall it in Siberia. These are all such exciting projects, and nobody's laughing anymore. They're possible.
There are some people who think that maybe it's not really practical or not really ethical. You've responded that you think it is ethical and practical. Let's start with that argument.
I think it's more than practical and possible. I do have a very strong feeling that if we can see the finger of man, if you like, as the responsible factor for why some of these iconic species are gone, then I feel we have a moral responsibility, and I'd even argue a moral imperative, if we can be smart human to start to undo the time when we played inappropriately like gods and exterminated species, then I think we have this moral imperative to try to do that. This isn't just toys or fun or just seeing what we can do. We're actually trying to fix what we broke. And that, to me, is very important.
John Weems, you've expressed some skepticism about this. What are your concerns?
I think it's actually a great and a wonderful thing. But at the same time, I don't think it should be the highest priority. The highest priority should be to preserve species in their natural environments. And when we do that, that's how we're going to preserve the maximum number of species in the shortest amount of time and the minimum cost. As some people say, try to save all the pieces. Rather than trying to put things back together again. I think the second line of defense is zoos. You know, once things are still alive, but maybe can't be in the wild anymore. And then I think the de-extinction is a wonderful third route, but I would say that it should be the lowest priority.
Can I pop into that one, John? I agree with you about that. But on the other hand, if we do this sequentially, if we say, first, we're going to try to keep them in the wild, and if that doesn't work, well, hang on, we'll keep them alive in the zoos. And if that doesn't work, oh, well, let's go back to square one and maybe try to bring something back from the dead. But these are parallel activities. I don't see them as alternatives. I can't see any reason why, because different monies are involved, different kinds of support are going on here, why we shouldn't be trying de-extinction projects simultaneously with maintaining that commitment to conserving living species. And in the process, what we're finding, what I heard at the Revive and Restore and De-Extinction events National Geographic was running, were that people are talking about cross-species cloning. This is a key to de-extinction projects. And that actually is an extremely important tool for modern conservationists to increase the numbers of endangered species by taking cells from the endangered species, popping them into a common related species, and getting more of the endangered species back into the world. So I see these as compatible strategies rather than alternatives.
Carl Zimmer, what is it that you're hearing from the rest of the scientific community?
The other people I'm talking to are discussing these very issues. Another thing that comes up in my discussions with scientists is the question of what it really means to bring something back from extinction. Because if you just make one animal. Well, that's a scientifically an impressive feat, but one animal is not a species. A species is a viable population that can sustain itself. And if you create just enough to survive in a zoo, for example, well, some scientists would say, well, that's kind of functionally extinct. And we actually have some species right now where they're basically only in zoos. It's not really what you think of when you think of biodiversity. So really, ultimately, the real test of de-extinction for a lot of scientists would be actually being able to put something back out in the wild. And there again, it's a very tricky issue because if they became extinct because of something that happened in their habitat, if that habitat is still a mess, then you might just watch them going extinct again. And there are diseases that have broken out that have driven a number of species extinct. Frogs, a number of frog species, for example, they're still out there, and nobody has any good way to cure these diseases that are caused by fungi. So if you were to bring back a frog, as Dr. Archer is doing, who's to say that you put it out in the wild and they all die of the same fungus again? So these are the kinds of questions that de-extinction is raising.
John Weems?
I agree with both Carl and Mike, but I think there does need to be this hierarchy that the first and most important priority is preserving the habitat. Again, like Carl said, if you de-extinct something, you have to have a place to put it besides just a zoo or a laboratory. There has to be a habitat for it. There has to be an environment. And so I think that is the first priority in terms of preservation. And I agree with Michael that these things can be going on in parallel, but I do think strongly that there has to be a sort of a hierarchy or I think that there's the way to get the most bang for the buck in terms of preserving biodiversity is going to be from protecting habitats.
Let's take a slight turn and talk about what has been done. Michael Archer, you've got this project, the Lazarus Project. I think that's the one in which you are bringing the frog back. How close are you to doing this?
Well, a lot closer than we expected to be when we started this project, I have to say. This is a kind of a classic cloning project, but it's different than Dolly the sheep. Dolly involved taking a live sheep body cell and using the DNA from that to put into a live sheep egg cell. And, you know, it was a miracle when it happened in 1996, but suddenly there was a cloned sheep. What we're trying to do, and so far have amazingly succeeded, at least far as we've gotten, is to take the nucleus from a dead cell from an extinct species. We have some old frozen tissue that was shoved in a freezer between 30 and 40 years ago, and then take that dead nucleus and put it into the egg cell of a living frog of a different kind. So it's cross-species cloning. We had no reason to expect it was going to work because of all of the obvious new challenges involved. But amazingly to us, after only probably 400 or 500 of these injections, one of these suddenly divided, and then it kept dividing and eventually produced an embryo that is the sort of precursor to developing a tadpole. But it didn't go on to produce a tadpole. It just stopped at that point. And that is our hurdle. We have done parallel experiments working with living frogs, so no dead tissues involved. And when we do the same things with them, they also stop at that same stage. So we suspect we've got a technological problem in front of us now, nothing to do with a problem with the extinct frog's DNA. But how long before we actually get a tadpole and a frog? You know, we're out at the edge, beyond the edge of the known in terms of doing things like this. So we don't have any signposts. We don't have any guidelines to tell us. We're just guessing. But considering we've got this far in what amounts to basically only about a month and a half of work, albeit spread over a five-year period, I'm kind of hopeful in the next few years we're going to have this frog hopping glad to be back in the world again. One of the things that we hope to be able to do is get this frog back in the wild. And I think what John and Carl are saying are critical. We need to know that all of this effort is going to have that potential outcome. And for us, that's probably going to involve selective breeding in the laboratory colony for resistance to that fungus. Many frogs around the world are starting to show this resistance. But in those cases, there are thousands of frogs. Most of them go, but a few show resistance, and the next generation breeds from those. We'd hope to be able to do that artificially in a lab so that the gastric brooding frog, which is what we're trying to get back here, that gets put back in the wild, will be able to stick its tongue out at that fungus and survive.
Suppose you're successful with this particular frog. How do you choose which animal to bring back from extinction on the next round?
There's a lot of thinking about that, and I can only say
what our attitude has been in the Lazarus Project. And that is, you know, A, did we as humans drive it extinct? So that puts it on our candidate list. Two, is it a really distinctive animal? In other words, in this case, this frog represented a whole family of frogs. So it's a very unique chunk of the global genomic diversity of the world. So if we could get this back, it's not just another frog, it's a very special frog. And there's a third reason in this case, which is not necessarily applicable to all these other candidates. In this case, this frog also did something so amazing that humans are interested in understanding how it did this in order to see how it might benefit us. These frogs converted their stomach into a uterus. They raised their young in their stomach. And that was so amazing to the medical fraternity that they wanted to research this, find out how it did it, and suddenly it was extinct. So a lot of reasons why you would pick particular species to focus this attention on.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about whether or not scientists should try to bring back some extinct species through cloning. Let's go back to the ecosystem issue. John Means, when an animal goes extinct in a particular ecosystem, and we talked briefly about sometimes it collapses, sometimes it doesn't, but generally it's changed when an animal is extinct in an ecosystem. What generally happens? What kind of changes do we see? And then what would happen if you reintroduced it, say, 40 years or 400 years later?
Wow, that's tough. It's going to depend a lot, I think, on the species that you're talking about. It may be that in some cases, there isn't necessarily a huge impact. In other cases, some species we call keystone species, a lot of other species depend on them. And so removing them could be devastating. So it's going to vary a lot from species to species of how much overall effect they have on an ecosystem.
Carl Zimmer, would you say the scientific community is on one side or on another of this, or are they split down the middle?
I really think it's too early to say. For a lot of scientists, they're only becoming aware that this is actually even feasible right now. With the article in National Geographic and the meeting that was held recently for TEDx, this is really the first time that these issues have been brought up outside of script room where somebody is coming up with the next episode of Jurassic Park. So when I talk to people, often they're just trying to think about this kind of in the hypothetical and then try to sort of move from the hypothetical to the possible. It reminds me of what was happening in the early 1970s when scientists were fiddling around with enzymes. And they realized that they could move a gene from one species into another. And so they took a gene from a frog and they stuck it into E. coli. So suddenly you had this almost like a microbe-frog hybrid. Suddenly scientists had gone from thinking, well, this might be interesting, to seeing that this could really happen. And then suddenly the whole scientific community started getting involved in the big discussion of what would become known as genetic engineering. And that took a few years. There were a lot of concerns raised about the possible risks and a lot of big promises that were made. And, you know, the big promises never came through. The big warnings never materialized. But there was something sort of in between. You know, that may be how things develop here, but we're really just at the beginning of that conversation.
One of the other phrases that I saw Michael Archer was this idea of the global genome. You've said that perhaps we conserve as much of the global genome as we can for the purpose of giving the world resilience. For the non-scientists among us, what exactly is the global genome? Is this the entirety of DNA? And does it necessarily give the world resistance?
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. Biologically, of course, is the focus that I have. But it actually is a cultural focus. It could be an economic focus. I think all of us, no matter what discipline we're actually working in, understand that simple systems are prone to being tipped over. The less resilient the base for whatever system, whether it's cultural, economic, biological, however broad that base is, we give greater stability to what it is we depend on that's built on that base. And biological systems are pretty much the same. The more you simplify them by taking species out or by reducing the amount of diversity or space that they have to operate in, the greater the probability that a simple little push or a shove coming in from outside will tip the whole thing over. The global financial crisis was a similar thing. I think for most people in the world, we all wondered how on earth could something as catastrophic as that happen from what seemed to be simple drivers? And yet it was about simplification. It was about taking away the resilience of the system, and it can fall over. Life systems are the same. The global genome, the bigger and broader it is, the more life has, if you like, in its bag of tricks, the more capacity it has to respond to changes in the environment or changes in the world. While we are obliterating the comfortable climate zones that the planet has, we need to know life has got the toolkit to be able to respond and survive these changes. And if we've taken away a lot of its tools, more of it's going to fall over when the crisis hits.
I would like to hear John Wien's response to that. If, in fact, we can conserve this global genome and it does give the world resistance, does it give us the justification for moving forward on this kind of project?
I think that there may be two separate issues. And one is, I strongly agree with Michael, there's a strong scientific basis for saying that more biodiverse systems, like more biodiverse ecosystems, seem to be more resilient to change. And also, they do more for us. There's this important idea of ecosystem function. And functioning natural ecosystems do so many things for us. They purify our water. They give us oxygen. They give us food. They do all these things that it would be impossible to pay for. Just a natural functioning ecosystem just does all these amazing things. And it seems to be that not only are functioning diverse ecosystems more resilient, but they also do more. They function better. So that's a strong argument for preserving biodiversity. I think it's maybe another question whether de-extincting some species is going to be a major part of that, if it's going to have enough, you know, effects on the ecosystem to make a big difference on the global scale. But I think in the end, I think we all want the same thing, is that we do want to preserve as much diversity as possible.
Michael Archer, when you de-extinct a particular, say, animal, there are a couple of concerns that have been raised. One is whether or not that animal is going to have fundamental flaws, kind of like Dolly the sheep did or others, or even when people inbreed animals, they tend to have these congenital illnesses. Is that a big risk? And then the second one is animals over time evolve and adopt to an environment socially. Is that coded in the DNA that you are then using, or is that something that is learned?
Yeah, those are fascinating questions. And of course, to a certain extent, I guess we're only going to discover these through the trial and error of doing work of this kind. And in response to your first question, unquestionably, there are going to be unacceptable outcomes for some of the early experiments in de-extincting. In fact, the Pyrenean ibex this is the Bucardo, it's a goat. It was cloned nearly 10 years ago from the last individual that died, had been, in fact, hit by a tree. And the offspring from that actually came out with an extra bit of a lung, and it didn't work. But most technologies like this always start out with flaws, and then as you understand more about the processes, they get better and better with less flaws and more efficiency. Cloning is now standard in agriculture. People are doing it all the time to produce perfectly healthy cattle, arguably cattle, for example, that are even going to live longer than normal cattle. There's amazing things here. So I'm not terribly worried about that. The beginnings of these new technological things like IVF and all these other things always have hiccups to start, and then they get sorted out, and then everybody begins to take it for granted. But your second question is equally interesting. To what extent, when we bring back an extinct animal, particularly one that there may be no actual memories of how these animals behaved, supposing we do manage to get back a mammoth, are we actually going to know whether that mammoth is behaving like a mammoth or not? I'm not sure it matters too much. I do know that a lot of animal behavior is definitely hardwired into the genome. When you think about cats, you know, we don't buy adult cats. We tend to buy kittens, and they barely have their eyes open. They haven't done anything except lick their mother's milk. And yet when that kitten grows up with no training or anything else, suddenly there's all these horrible behaviors about mutilating mice. They know exactly what to do. It's hardwired behavior. My guess is we'll find that's true for most animals. We look at the animal kingdom through our own eyes, and we think about all of the behaviors we have that are learned, and we assume that's true for everything else, and it's not. About 95% of the behavior of most animals in the rest of the world is hardwired. It's instinctual. So I think if we get some of these extinct animals back, I'd expect the vast majority of those behaviors to simply click straight in.
Carl Zimmer, you get the last word.
We're talking about an extinction crisis that is affecting perhaps thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe ultimately even millions of species. And the work that's involved to bring back even one species from extinction is huge. You know, we really have to ask just how practical it can be to try to bring back these species, to figure out the biology, to work out the cloning, and all the rest, to bring back sort of a handful of species. That doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't do it. It just might mean that we can't pretend that we could somehow make up even a tiny part of the deficit we're going to be facing. That being said, one way that the extinction might actually prove to be very powerful might actually be really psychological. Because if people see the frog that Mike Archer is trying to bring back, or if they see a passenger pigeon, or if they see a woolly mammoth, that's going to make them think about all the species that are not with us and all the species that we're about to lose. And maybe that will lead to more of a broad-based change in people's attitudes. That's going to be what's going to let us deal with the extinction crisis.
John Weems.
You can imagine it working exactly in reverse. And people saying, oh, we don't need to worry about preserving things in the wild or in zoos because we can just bring them back.
Carl Zimmer, Michael Archer, and John Weems, I'd like to extend a very big thank you for joining us on this and helping us understand this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Archer is a professor of biological earth and environmental sciences at the University of New South Wales. He has published more than 300 scientific journal articles focusing on the ecology and evolution of past and present, and has been working to bring back some extinct animals. John Weems is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona and author of numerous publications and the book, The Ecology of Bird Communities. Carl Zimmer is an award-winning lecturer at Yale University and the author of 13 books, including his latest, A Planet of Viruses and Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.
Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies. On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences, gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. Can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't